This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I'm going to say it now just to timestamp it in front of y'all. Green shoots from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 18th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Okay, wait. Before you ask, yes, those green shoots are very, very slender indeed. And the reaction on Wall Street today to reports of that promising drug trial, 8 people in the study for an experimental vaccine, well, the reaction does seem optimistic. But big picture wise, there was some not so bad news in the news fire hose the past day or so. Jay Powell in that interview on 60 Minutes last night saying again that the Fed is going to do what it takes and that Congress should too. Oil did real well today on increasing demand. And related, Detroit got back to work today, partially anyway. About the half of the car making workforce in this economy is headed back to work, about 130,000 people, give or take. Of course, to make an American car these days, you need parts and components from Mexico. Lots of them. And of course, the pandemic hit down there as well. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports that the pressure is on to get Mexico back in the North American supply chain, and pronto.
A typical part in a U.S.-made car has crossed the border into Canada or Mexico 8 times before final assembly. U.S. automakers depend so much on Mexican partners that they've waged a pressure campaign for them to start back up, says Duncan Wood at the Wilson Center think tank.
They have spoken to the Mexican government. They've spoken to business associations in Mexico. We've also seen through the State Department stronger and stronger messages saying that Mexico needs to think about the ways in which it cooperates with its North American partners.
It seemed to work. Last week, Mexico's government declared auto plants essential, letting them restart this week. But the pandemic risk there may be high, says supply chain consultant Jeff Burris at Advanced Purchasing Dynamics.
People are literally sitting within 2 or 3 feet of each other because you're passing an assembly product down the line.
And in Mexico, the virus hit later than in the U.S., so the number of cases there is still going up. Fernando Alarid Escuduro is with the Center for Research and Economics in Mexico.
We are behind in terms of getting our highest number of cases, at least a month behind compared to New York City.
So for all the risk, can the North American auto supply chain put itself back together safely and quickly? There's not much margin for error as U.S. factories keep limited inventory. Economist Tom Fullerton watches cross-border supply chains at the University of Texas, El Paso.
They probably have enough inventory of spare parts to get them through the next 12 days. Any type of disruption to the supply chain is going to be short-lived at best.
He's an optimist, but others aren't so sure. In Alabama, Mercedes has halted operations because it can't get the parts it needs from Mexico. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There seems to be something of a disconnect between what Congress has done to keep this crisis from getting way worse, and what people are feeling in their wallets about what Congress has done to keep this crisis from getting way worse. There are, of course, trillions of dollars in rescue money that have been authorized, billions in extra unemployment benefits. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, whether that money is getting where it's supposed to go is another question entirely.
According to the Treasury Department, federal and state governments had sent out $48 billion in unemployment checks by the end of April. But the amount of income Americans lost in April from layoffs and lack of work due to the pandemic was at least $80 billion, according to the Brookings Institution's Hamilton Project. Jay Shambaugh is the director.
The unemployment insurance probably covered about half of the drop in personal wage and salary income. It's not that everybody's getting half as much unemployment insurance as they should. It's really more half of people are getting covered and half are getting nothing right now.
A major problem is that states have struggled to get up to speed with the new Federal Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, or PUA, says Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project.
A lot of people don't understand that they're eligible for PUA. Some states are completely denying people for regular unemployment insurance and then inviting them to reapply for pandemic unemployment assistance.
And in many states, it's been hard to make a regular unemployment claim in the first place. Florida's been notorious. Its antiquated computers and understaffed offices have been overwhelmed.
I applied in the middle of the night on April 8th.
James Gamboa is 46. He got laid off in mid-March from his job tending bar poolside at a big Miami hotel. He applied for unemployment as soon as he used up all his vacation time.
It took 3 to 5 hours to submit my claim because I was being kicked off the website repeatedly. Took a couple weeks for it to be processed.
But he still hasn't gotten his checks going back to early April, meaning he's out about $2,700 he needs to pay rent. Since mid-March, Florida has processed just about half the unemployment applications it's received. By contrast, New York and Massachusetts have processed 70 to 90% of their claims. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, everything's fine, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is going to rub some people the wrong way, I imagine, but higher education is a business. And right now, that business is in a tough spot. Refunds for the semester now ending. Enrollment for semesters yet to come unknowable right now amid an overall shift away from campus and toward Zoom and technology and the like. And so the education technology company Chegg is having, as they say, a moment. Dan Rosenzweig is the CEO of Chegg. Dan, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai. It's been a while. How you been?
I've been well. Higher education, though, as you know, is sort of in a different plane of existence. And let me just start with you as a guy in this field now, surveying education online, as so many parents and kids are doing. What's your gut telling you? What do you think?
Well, my gut's telling me that, like many things in life, crises is like this sort of accelerate or accentuate a trend that's already happening, and then they become permanent. And so there has always been a desire to move education online. There's always been a desire to make it more affordable, to be able to actually allow the population that goes to college today, which is 25 years old, not 18 to 22. Most of them go to a state school. They have jobs. They have children. They need to be able to have education come to them. And so this is going to be a real wake-up call for higher education. And I think we're going to see some dramatic changes in the next few years.
Okay, next few years is great, but we got kids who need educating right now who can't get into a classroom. And I don't know what age your kids are. I span seventh grade to just graduated from college this past weekend. And I'll tell you, the past, what's it been, like 10 weeks? The education that they have been getting has been, you know?
Yeah, look, let's break it into two groups. Let's break it into where you have to homeschool, and that has been really difficult for parents to do, and the curriculum wasn't ready for it, the technology wasn't ready for it, the schools didn't invest in it. In higher education, it's even more difficult, because for years, higher education has argued against putting anything online because they wanted to be able to charge the high rates of coming to college. Colleges are going to open up no matter what, because economically, it's an imperative for them. The question is, if they do it, will they do it on campus, online, or both? And will anybody come? And so I think we're going to see, you know, I've been predicting, not happily, by the way, that about 20 to 25% of colleges are going to go bankrupt, that the schools with the best endowments are going to take all the full payers, and we're going to have a lot of schools in the middle who are going to be struggling financially.
So there's going to be a winnowing. That's what I hear you saying, right?
I think it's going to be quite significant. We heard the mayor of Ithaca this morning on CNBC saying that Cornell, which has a $7 billion endowment, if it doesn't open, the town of Ithaca is going to be in deep trouble. and Wells College, which is an all-women's college in upstate New York, if they don't open this semester, they've already said they're never going to open again. So we're going to see a change, and it's going to be dramatic, and a lot of schools just aren't going
to
make it.
It is, we have to point out here, a business opportunity for you and your company, right?
Yes. It's not the one we were hoping for, but it is the one that that's in front of us, which is nobody would want to see what we're seeing. But we have been predicting for 10 years that if colleges didn't increase their curriculum to be more job-ready curriculum, and if they didn't lower their prices, and if they didn't use technology to the advantage of the student, why is it that schools have not adapted to what the needs are of their communities? And so this is going to be a forcing function for state schools and for community colleges. And I think the aftermath might be great, but the short term is going to be devastating to a lot of schools, a lot of faculty, and unfortunately, a lot of students.
Do you suppose there's a chance, last question, Dan, and then I'll let you go. Mm-hmm. Do you suppose there's a chance that we get through this, whatever through it looks like, and everybody goes, phew, okay, let's get back to education the way we used to do it?
No. I don't think families will allow it. I don't think people will pay the price that they've been paying. I don't think people will put the same value on dorms and food. I think there's going to be an acceleration given the job losses from learning to earning. No way in the world it goes back to what it was, and no way that it should.
Dan Rosenzweig, he's the CEO of Chegg. Dan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you, as always, and appreciate it, and stay safe.
Jack Dorsey has apparently pretty much decided he is done with the office environment. Dorsey runs Twitter, as you may know, which announced the other day that any of its people who want to work from home forever, well, they can. He also runs Square, the payment company, which made basically the same announcement today. And it turns out 20% or so of the companies in the San Francisco Bay Area are following that lead and planning to keep people home even after stay-at-home orders are lifted. Maybe not forever, but who knows? So says a survey by the Bay Area Council. But look, if everybody's working from home, does that home really need to be in a super expensive high-tech hub? From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Andrew Edelman has worked his way up in the technology world as a product manager and strategist at companies from Charlotte to Chicago and now Silicon Valley.
From a tech standpoint, this is the place to be. But I've got four kids. I've got a really tiny house.
He's now head of strategic alliances at the workflow automation software company Zapier, which, as a way of retaining employees, offers a $10,000 bonus to move out of the super expensive Bay Area. So Edelman is taking the offer and moving his family to Austin.
We're moving from about 1,400 square feet here in the Bay Area to almost 3,000 square feet in Texas. And it's 33% cheaper.
With Silicon Valley's iconic campuses, volleyball courts, and meditation rooms emptied out for the foreseeable future, the prospect of leaving town for more affordable cities could be gaining appeal.
What's going to be really interesting to me is what the landscape of the U.S. will look like when people continue to start thinking about another city to live in.
Aaron Belsley heads Tulsa Remote, a program to recruit and pay remote workers $10,000 to move to Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's seen a surge in new applications since the pandemic began.
There is a certain amount of risk associated with making such a huge shift. Well, that burden of taking that risk has been removed.
Because when you're working from your dining room, it doesn't really matter what city you're in. But while many tech jobs are remote ready and have been for a while, the industry has clung to the importance of place, says Margaret O'Mara, the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America.
This notion that our innovative magic depends on everyone being at the Googleplex or being at Facebook HQ or Amazon HQ so that people can have those accidental serendipitous encounters.
Not just within a company, but in an entire region. It's the appeal of agglomeration. Tech workers want to be around other tech workers.
That is a pattern that is deeply, deeply rooted, and one pandemic is not going to end that.
Which is part of why Andrew Edelman chose to decamp to Austin, home to thousands of employees of Apple, Google, and Facebook.
We would have loved to move to somewhere like Wyoming or Kauai, but at the same time, staying plugged into the tech scene was really important.
which suggests cities that want to attract remote techies from Topeka to Tulsa might have a hard time competing against places that already have a lot of them. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That first week, we took over 5,600 calls and answered 3,000 emails.
A dispatch from the Paycheck Protection Program straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. 911 points to the upside for the Dow Industrials, 3.8%, 24,597. The NASDAQ up 220 points. 2.4%, 92.34. The S&P 500 up 90, that is 3.1%, ended things at 29.53. That trial by the pharmaceutical firm Moderna, I don't know what a pharmaceutical firm is. Anyway, did wonders. Among the winners today, travel cruise ship companies did really well. Royal Caribbean banked 16%, Carnival gained 15%, Norwegian Cruise Lines finished the day 18% higher. Airlines, too, United up better than 20%. American ticked up 9%. Delta took off with 13%. Moderna stock itself banked almost 20% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to the supply chain we go now. Scott was talking about it up at the top of the program with cars. But maybe the most consumer-facing supply chain we've all become aware of the past couple of months is food. That early rush to grocery stores, the meatpacking plants that have become coronavirus hotspots, how what we eat gets from there to our table. Our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has a new season out. It's called A History of Now. And the first episode is about poultry workers and what they go through to get chicken from there to our tables. Marketplace's Caitlin Esch has been talking to one worker in central Mississippi.
I met William McNeil on a stormy morning back in February when things still felt normal in Mississippi. William is 46 years old.
And what do you do?
I catch chickens.
He catches chickens. He came right from his shift. He was still in his work clothes. Blue jeans, a sweatshirt, steel-toed boots. William goes out to farms that raise chickens for major poultry companies, usually in the middle of the night, heads into these huge chicken houses, and he grabs up live birds by hand, thousands of them in a single shift. To catch a chicken, he scoops them up by the feet, flips them upside down, careful to avoid the spurs, which can impale you, and holds their legs between his fingers. He can hold up to 15 small birds at a time using both hands.
This main hand that you put the chickens in, it disforms your knuckles, messes your hands up.
After 7 years of this work, William's knuckles are swollen and bent.
A lot of people, their hands never go down. Their hands always stay swollen out to big. You can tell they're a chicken catcher.
Catching chickens is hard on the body and on the lungs. There's a lot of dust, and when chicken poop breaks down, it releases ammonia. Some catchers say the smell is so strong in the chicken houses, you almost pass out.
This is a job nobody wants to do anymore, because it's nasty, it's dirty, and it don't pay enough.
The crew is paid a piece rate, not an hourly wage, so the chicken catchers try to catch birds as fast as they can. When he split the day's take with the rest of the crew, William got a little over $2 for every 1,000 birds they caught. So 23,000 chickens added up to about $47. That's less than $10 an hour, which doesn't include the time he spent riding in the company van to get to the chicken house.
We may make $25, we may make $115.
By March, the pandemic hit, and I couldn't visit. So we talked on the phone. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
He wasn't catching chickens anymore. He was driving the van that picks up the catchers at their homes in the middle of the night and brings them to the farm and drives them home again at the end of the shift. William wasn't social distancing. He doesn't have that luxury. He was working in close quarters with a crew of about 9 other people. They can't stay 6 feet away from each other. They weren't given any extra protective gear, no masks or hand sanitizer. It was basically business as usual.
I'm still going to work every day. My stepson still goes to work every day. My girlfriend still going to work every day.
William is considered an essential worker, so he's not laid off. He can't stay home and get unemployment. But William wants to work.
But I feel like I'm very important to the country. And I feel like I need to try to uphold my end, if I can, to make sure people eat, because this is a very critical time.
So you don't get sick days, right?
No, we don't get no sick days.
William works for a subcontractor hired by Cook Foods, a major poultry company. Cook Foods owns the chickens and the processing plant, but it subcontracts out the actual work of chicken catching to third-party businesses. That's who cuts William's paycheck. By the way, we reached out to both companies. Neither responded. Working for a subcontractor, William doesn't get benefits. No vacation days, no health insurance, no sick days. But William doesn't blame the people he works for so much. He's mad at the company that owns the chickens he catches, Cook Foods. He sees Cook as ultimately responsible for his wages.
I would want Cook to feel like that we're important to them too. Because even as we make sure people got food, we're making sure that their company still run without going under.
He said he wanted to be treated better. He wanted higher wages, hazard pay. I talked to William again in early May. He told me the contractor he works for has indicated he might start to get paid sick time temporarily during the crisis. And his employer has given them masks and hand sanitizer and Lysol. William says he drives with the windows open, sprays Lysol in the van. I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
Episode 2 of A History of Now from The Uncertain Hour is out on Wednesday. It's a history of quarantine's past and how one's income made a big difference. And hey, if you are looking for more to listen to right now, because honestly, who isn't? Me and Molly Wood every day. Our podcast, Make Me Smart, making today make sense. Check it out. Earlier this year, in the before times, we started a series called The United States of Work. 10 people we had found who form a give-or-take representative sample of the American labor force as a whole. It's not, obviously, the series we hoped it'd be, because life. But we're staying in touch with our 10 as this economic crisis does its thing. Today's dispatch is from Kate Bellino. She's a new accounts representative with First Bank in Centennial, Colorado. Normally, she's in a branch office talking to customers. Nowadays, though, she's on the front lines of the government's small business loan program.
So at the beginning of April, I switched roles a little bit with the bank. Instead of working in the branch, I was asked to be a representative for our PPP, our Payroll Protection Program Support Center within the bank, just answering phone calls, answering questions, helping customers with application questions. And that first week was just absolutely nuts with different policies and procedures and changes almost every single hour. It was crazy trying to keep up with the program itself and the guidance we were getting from the SBA and the Treasury. But that first week, we took over 5,600 calls and answered 3,000 emails. And it was a team of 17 of us in that first week. So completely different from my regular responsibilities of being a new account representative with the bank. And since April 14th, I've been working from home. Honestly, the first couple weeks of working with the contact center has been a blur because the calls were just back to back to back. You never really had time to just pause and be like, okay, this was really hard, or okay, that was a really good call, or ooh, that was a little rough. But we hit the ground running and we're just now starting to slow down. last week, we brought our team of probably 10 people down to 4. So now there's 4 of us working the contact center, just answering those lingering questions. We have a couple late applications that those applicants have questions that we're here to answer for. But we're anticipating in the next couple weeks, beginning of June, with the forgiveness portion of it, we're going to go into the second round of customer service with this program.
The This final note on the way out today, a dispatch from the beating heart of the gig economy. Uber announced today it's going to cut another 3,000 people, bringing its total layoffs to about 25% of its workforce. CEO Dara Khosrowshahi said in a staff email today that rides are down 80% since this whole thing started. Quoting that email now, Khosrowshahi said, "You have heard me say it before, hope is not a strategy." All right, here's your moment of economic context, picking up, I suppose, where the Uber CEO left off. The New York Fed does a survey of business leaders every month. Their May report out today asked a supplemental question because, you know, the crisis. How many more months, the New York Fed wanted to know, do these business leaders think it will be until things are back to normal? The average response in a most likely events scenario, 8 months. Worst case, 15. So there you go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.